This week on Life and Faith.
I think that my favourite thing about reading the Bible, I'm an English teacher, so I read aesthetically, which is to say I look for patterns. And my favourite pattern in the scriptures is the story of the little guy bringing God's goodness to the world. And it's always the little guy or the little girl. It's right, never the big guy with power.
Yes, it's sort of the insignificant, supposedly insignificant person, the most unlikely person.
Well, as I tell my students, you know, whenever you see a pattern, now we're talking about intent, you know. So if we see this pattern over and over and over again, and each of these little stories is telling us something, I think, about what the scripture altogether is saying.
Yeah, what is that saying?
Well, that is a big question.
Why are we here? Can I have a relationship with God? These kinds of things I can't measure with my microscope or my telescope.
Hope deranges us. Hope breaks things down.
Christianity isn't some kind of self-help doctrine. It's not probiotics for the soul or something, you know?
He was using the parable of the Good Samaritan to justify bombing Syria.
Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Justine Toe.
It's good to be with you. And today we're talking about the Book of the People, the biggest bestseller of all time, the Bible. What is it? Who reads it? What has its impact been? And why should we care?
You've been thinking about doing an episode on this for a long time, haven't you, Simon?
Yeah, I have actually. But partly that's because the Bible seems to have been in the news quite a lot lately, and not always in a really good way.
You think?
Yeah. And it seems that there are people all over the place happy to quote the Bible, sometimes quote things that aren't in the Bible, but they think are, things like God helps those who help themselves. And it seems it's such a misunderstood book that it was time to have a good think about it on Life and Faith.
Yes. Did you see how ex-Prime Minister Tony Abbott was giving a speech in London about Brexit? And in the middle of the speech, he quoted the Bible.
You'd say this.
Yeah. So he says, as the scripture says, he who puts his hand to the plough and then turns back is not worthy of the kingdom. And I'm like, I don't even understand what how is he trying to relate that to Brexit?
It's a clear reference to Brexit.
It's baffling, I have to admit.
And it's a total kind of misappropriation. We do seem to see this from time to time, don't we?
Yes. And in another episode of Life and Faith that people can chase up if they like, we had Nick Spencer, who's from London, but he, on that episode, was talking about the way that Jesus' parable of the Good Samaritan has been used and misused in politics.
Yeah, it's a really interesting book he wrote on that, and good episode.
Yeah, totally. But Simon, you were prompted to do this episode when you picked up a book by A.N. Wilson called The Book of the People, How to Read the Bible. So why did this particularly catch your eye?
Well, partly because A.N. Wilson is such an interesting person himself. So he's a biographer, highly regarded novelist, big in the world of literature and journalism. And when he was a young man, he spent, I think it was a year, training for the Anglican priesthood, but then he turned to a writing career. And then in middle age, he became an outspoken atheist. And he wrote about this as a pamphlet against religion and in a whole lot of other writing too. He was really critical of religion of all sorts.
Is it one of those things where because he left the faith and then he was even more vocal and more strident, was he like a kind of a new atheist type person?
He was a bit. And in fact, he was good friends with Christopher Hitchens, one of the new atheists, the late Christopher Hitchens. And yeah, A.N. Wilson was a feisty non-believer. But, and he talks about this nowadays when he writes about it, he couldn't ever quite shake the feeling of uneasiness he had with this sort of newfound unbelief. And it was his lifelong friendship with a believer who, in this book that I was reading, he just refers to as L. I think it's slightly irritating. But anyway, L was a friend of his and a really significant influence on him. And it turns out that she was always planning to write a book on the Bible, but she died before she could accomplish that. And you get the feeling that A.N. Wilson has kind of taken this task on for her.
Now, of course, I want to know, who was L? Any clues?
You don't find out in the book, and so no, I don't know. But he talked about the things that she used to say, and so he quotes sometimes letters from her and postcards and things they said as they wandered around galleries and so on. And she talked about the great loss there is in not reading the Bible and soaking in it, and how she reckoned it was the first time now, our contemporary times, the first time that intelligent people were not reading the Bible. And she used to joke with him and say, people are still under this illusion that we're living outside of the world of the Bible just because we're not reading it anymore, which she thought was nonsense. And there's a point in the book where he's talking about his friend, L, and he says he was so troubled by her all through this period of his life. He said she was one of those God-stricken people, he said, in love with God. And he reckoned he found that infuriating at one level, but also fascinating, and he envied this. He said he knew that because she was God-stricken, that she could read not just the Bible, but also other old texts like Dante's poetry or Blake, people like that, with what he called a heightened imaginative awareness. He thought that was a real advantage, and he kind of envied that in her.
Now, he eventually returned to his faith, didn't he?
He did, famously. He abandoned his atheism in the end, was sort of how he described it. And he essentially came to be disillusioned with the idea of naturalism, you know, there's no God or gods, and materialism, you know, the material is all that there is. That became for him what he said was the most boring and least accurate way of experiencing the world. And as he confronted that, he was sort of slowly led back to belief.
And so do you know what role the Bible played in that coming back to faith?
A big role. He reckons that the more he read, for instance, the Easter story, the more it seemed to apply and fit the human condition as he saw it. So A.N. Wilson is trying to persuade people to read the Bible. He thinks it's a huge loss not to. He says you've got to take the text as a whole and how it's come to us as a lively, dynamic text that's developed over time. He wants to highlight this, what he says are the sublime stories of the Bible that point us in the direction of this idea that men and women are not sort of solely earthbound creatures.
Yeah, there's more than what seems apparent to our eyes.
Yes, and he's very critical of fundamentalist readings of the Bible that he says not just believers but non-believers have adopted. He says this has ruined the experience. It takes care and nuance to read the Bible well. But he says there are enormous rewards if you're prepared to do that. So today on Life and Faith, and next week actually, we look at the Bible.
We've got a series of interviews for our look at the Bible and some Bible scholars who've been in town. First up, it's Ben Witherington III, who has written a commentary on every book of the New Testament. Seems like he knows too much about these texts.
Yep.
CVX's Mark Stevens went out to speak to Ben, and he began by asking the obvious question, what is the Bible?
Well, the Bible is a composition, as Protestants would say, of 66 books, 39 Old Testament, 27 New Testament, that was composed over the period of at least 1,500 years, if not more. And it really is more like a library than an individual book, because there are literally dozens, if not hundreds, of people involved in the composition of this work. And it's the most read, most owned, best-selling book of all time. So even if you're simply a listener who is generally interested in ancient literature or great literature or whatever, certainly this is one of the books you ought to know, for sure. And the Bible is more like going to a library and checking out several books than it is like just reading one.
Darrell Bock is another of our experts and an old friend of CPX. He's from Dallas Theological Seminary and a renowned New Testament scholar, also with a Southern American accent. He has a different angle on the same question. What is the Bible?
There really are two ways to think about the Bible. Obviously, for the Christian faith, it is their sacred scripture, their inspired text, the material from which their theology comes forth and their worldview and the way they see the world, etc. So there's that dimension of it. A second dimension of it actually impacts everybody. And that is the impact that the Bible has had throughout history and civilization as a way of thinking about how we live. And many of the institutions that we have, particularly in the West, have been influenced at their very base level by values and things that the Bible has taught and said. So whether you're actually a Christian or not, the Bible is an important text because it has helped to shape the world that we have lived in, our ancestors, if you will, even as the position of the Bible is being reflected upon and in some cases debated today.
Whether we're familiar with it or not, the Bible gets into our values, our imaginations, the themes our culture tells itself. It's seeped into our art and our music and our literature. So everything from Handel's Messiah to Nick Cave, famous Australian rock singer, Paul Kelly as well, more recently, Gang of Youths. You can see heaps of Bible references and themes in all this kind of work. So novelists and playwrights, poets, and so on. They kind of pick up from scripture things like storylines, archetypal storylines, imagery, themes, this kind of stuff.
Yeah, did you happen to watch Darren Aronofsky's Noah? He's an American filmmaker. Mm. And he's retelling the story of the flood, the great flood that's talked about in the book of Genesis in the Bible. And what's more interesting as well is that his follow-up film is called Mother, all lowercase with an exclamation mark. I don't know why there's such care taken with this sort of grammar. But anyway, that story takes on the whole of the Bible's big story, I suppose. So you've got Javier Bardem playing like almost like a poet figure, which pictures God as this like a glory hound, someone who's really after his own reputation and wants people to adore him. And then Jennifer Lawrence is playing his wife, a kind of mother nature figure who is abused and used by the people. And it's quite remarkable because, you know, people were baffled by this film. What is going on here? It's a horror film. What is happening? But Alyssa Wilkinson, who we've also had on Life and Faith, she was the former film critic for Christianity Today, and now she's writing for Vox.com. And she wrote a review that actually pinned the biblical references to their source. And I know Darren Aronofsky has said publicly that she's one of the very few people who actually understood what he was trying to convey.
That's fascinating, isn't it? So that's a kind of very contemporary example of this, that we've seen for hundreds and hundreds of years, the way the Bible has this kind of influence. And in a sense, if you don't know something of the Bible, you're going to be missing out on those references and understanding what these artists are really driving at. This is Life and Faith, and today we're talking about the Bible and its influence on our culture. And to explore this a little bit further, we're getting some help today from Dr. Sarah Goldsby-Smith. She's a teacher and literary critic, loves bringing both literature and the Bible to life for people. She came into the studio, and I first asked her, why is the Bible an important book to know for someone, even if they're not of a religious kind of disposition? And especially thinking about her area of expertise, which is literature and the arts.
I think that it is very difficult to get a grip on studying literature, particularly written in English, without having some sense of the broader Christian story and the way that's understood over time. So I think that Christian ideas, Christian identities, Christian motifs, all of those things, if you haven't had some education in what that looks like in its original form in the scriptures, it can feel a bit seasick.
And people tend to not have much knowledge of that these days, don't they?
I think that's true.
So that becomes a challenge for someone like you who's trying to teach people literature. But, but not only that, is there a gap there? Is there something people are missing out on, perhaps?
Oh, definitely. Mm. Definitely that's true. And I don't mean that they should know more about the Bible so that they can, you know, join the club. That's not what I mean. For example, I remember teaching T.S. Eliot's Magi to a wonderful bunch of, I used to lightheartedly call them my favourite pagans because they knew so little about the scriptures. But in Journey of the Magi, there are all of these amazing references to the scriptures. And unless you know the stories, the meaning of the poem and the import of the poem is lost.
Yes.
Whether the import of that poem is a Christian message or not.
Yeah.
You know, the signposts aren't there.
No. And can you give us some other examples of that from literature where a knowledge of the Bible would be really helpful in understanding the work?
My favourite example of this, and this is not one that I've taught, my favourite reading experience in the last 2 years would have to be Tim Winton's The Shepherd's Hut. Mm-hmm. It blew me away.
Yeah.
And as I got to the end, I realised that I'm sure that I read lots of commentators who were saying things like that Tim Winton was giving us a major comment on toxic masculinity, which I think is true. But I think that unless you had read the scriptures, your understanding of what he was doing towards the end of that novel to do with identity, male identity, was significantly weakened if you didn't know something about the passion. And there are all of these motifs of the passion all of the way through it, which is wrapped up, I think, in what Winton is saying about love and the way men, particularly Australian men, can love each other.
We had Tim Winton in here talking about that very
book. Are you serious? I didn't hear that.
Well, you have to go back and listen. I did talk to him about toxic masculinity too.
But oh, he's got things to say about it.
But we definitely did sort of, without trying to give the ending away, did sort of nudge towards that. I mean, and what's any other examples? You mentioned T.S. Eliot. You mentioned Tim Winton.
Mm.
Any other things that come to mind as, you know, ones where, yeah, the Bible helps you to understand this.
Oh, my gosh. Where do I even start? I'm teaching Seamus Heaney at the moment.
Uh-huh. The Irish poet.
Yes, the Irish poet. He's wonderfully approachable. We just finished one of his poems, and all the way through there are references to Celtic Christianity and to the Irish figure St. Patrick. And unless you understand something of that, I think it is very difficult to come to an understanding of what Heaney's saying about how we can reach past, say, Catholic and Protestant divisions to a kind of belief that transcends that division. So that's one example.
Sometimes people might be thinking, yeah, okay, but I left school. I don't study English anymore.
Right.
But still, you're going to urge them to know these stories, aren't you?
Well, they're so interesting.
Right.
They're so interesting, and they make the reading of these stories so much richer.
What are the big biblical themes that we see repeated across literature in this tradition?
Right. One of the big ones that keeps coming up in everything that I teach, it seems, is the motif of water, which the Bible begins with water. And water in the scriptures represents primordial chaos. And then God's carefully constructed creation actually comes through the water. So once you kind of got that concept, some of the stories in the Bible start to make a little bit more sense, you know, like Moses holding back the water so that the Israelites can walk through. And then you've got Jesus walking on water.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this, and those sorts of themes are picked up again and again, I think, in literature.
What about the Bible itself?
Yes.
What rewards does it offer someone who might pick it up and read to understand the stories and its influence? What are they going to find there?
I think that my favourite thing about reading the Bible, I'm an English teacher, so I read aesthetically, which is to say I look for patterns. I probably am a little bit of a different reader from the way church taught me to read because of my English training. So I like to look for patterns, and my favourite pattern in the scriptures is the story of the little guy bringing God's goodness to the world. And it's always the little guy or the little girl. It's right, never the big guy with power.
Yes, it's sort of the insignificant, insignificant person, the most unlikely person.
Well, as I tell my students, you know, whenever you see a pattern, now we're talking about intent, you know. So if we see this pattern over and over and over again, and each of these little stories is telling us something, I think, about what the scripture altogether is saying.
Yeah, what is that saying?
Well, that is a big question. To me, it says that God's grace is coming, but that it comes to us through the most unlikely, unsuspecting, mundane, quotidian moments of our lives.
What are some of the most frustrating things for you in terms of how people sometimes read the Bible that, you know, you think, oh, this is terrible and we need to change our way here?
I have very little tolerance for bad reading, whether that's the reading of literature or the reading of the Bible. That makes me sound really arrogant, doesn't it? And I don't mean that I always get it right, but I think what frustrates me is that we have skipped over so much of the beauty of the text. So we can skip over beauty, we can miss the meaning entirely. So I think careful reading is so important to me, whether that be literature or the Bible.
It is very subjective, though.
Yeah.
And when it comes to the Bible, I guess there is a way of reading it well and reading it badly.
Agreed.
But how do we know which we're doing there? Like, what are the sort of things that we can do to help in that process?
Two things. We look for patterns. where there is no pattern, then I think we need to reassess the way we're going at it. We have to let the Bible shock us and to surprise us with readings that we did not expect. And the only way you can do that is look for patterns with an open mind. Secondly, I think that it's really important. I mean, I'm a good Protestant, so I actually think that it's really important to come at the Bible with whatever baggage you have. But I do think it is important to, like we would with any piece of literature, just do a little bit of Googling, I suppose.
Yeah, to learn from the wisdom of the past.
Yes, tradition. Yes. And there are very, very good readers of scripture. In the same way as now I'm teaching Seamus Heaney, I actually would like to borrow from people who spent their lives reading Heaney. In the same way, I do reach for people who read the Bible better than me.
Now, people might imagine that the Bible is so strange and ancient and maybe even boring that it might have very little to say about contemporary life. But what would you say to someone who's feeling like that?
Head to the Old Testament, strangely enough. I think that, I'm going to say something really broad here, and I don't know if this is true, but I actually think our culture has had enough of philosophizing about things, and I think that sometimes when we go to the New Testament with that, there's a certain kind of antagonism, I suppose, to being told what to do. Not that I think that's what the New Testament is doing, but it's easy to feel that. Whereas if you head to the Old Testament, you are firmly, boots and all, in the realm of stories, and everyone loves a story, and those stories are fantastic. I mean, who does not love David and Goliath? That never gets old. One of my favourite stories is Esther. That's just impossible to get around how great that story is. And the story doesn't mention God once, so there you go. But, yeah, I think I probably have gone to stories where God has used a woman, because I am one, and I'm interested in that. I'm interested in the ways in which our Western culture has elided those stories and neglected to, say, make those stories more a part of our Western tradition. Esther, Deborah, on and on, I could go on. Miriam, Ruth.
It's amazing that they're there, right? That in itself is a very interesting part of this, don't you think?
Oh, and it blew my mind the moment I realised that was intentional to have female heroes, that they weren't some kind of sideline act to the main show. They were the main show. As I mentioned with Luke's gospel, it's structured around women who seek to understand Jesus and the men who seek power and can't.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Let's talk about story for a minute, because you mentioned the Old Testament's full of these really interesting stories. The whole thing is considered a story, though.
Yes.
Even though there's different types of literature there. But the whole thing's a story. What does that mean then for people today, to find a kind of place within that story? Mm. I think it does offer you that, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I think what you're talking about is an identification with a character, which is what we do when we read fiction, that the empathy is the main engine of a story, I think, when it's told in narrative form. So finding a story, I mean, you just heard me say that I identify with the female characters. Every single one of us can identify, I think, with some of the stories that are told in the Old Testament, because, you know, they're about life, they're about death, they're about suffering, they're about being left out. They're about being betrayed. Which of us has not experienced all of those things? Different culture, different time, but outrage, falling in love, all of these things, it's all there.
Is this why it's so captivated people? It seems to speak to every age and every culture and at every point, doesn't it? It has something to say to everyone.
I think so. And I think that it's sufficiently rich enough, not only in the stories it tells, but in the way it tells them, that we get these variety of readings over a long period of time. I'm actually quite comfortable with the fact that people read a story in different ways. I think that the biblical narrative is absolutely rich enough to sustain that.
What does it mean to read the Bible as literature? And what do you mean by that, and what benefit might that bring?
Oh, reading the Bible as literature, I actually think it saved my life. I can remember sitting in church in first year uni thinking, I wish I got as much enjoyment out of reading the Bible as I do sitting in a lecture listening to one of my professors talking about Hamlet. I can remember thinking that. Reading the Bible as literature, I actually think that doesn't mean that we're degrading it by treating it, say, in the same way as we would Shakespeare. It actually means that we think the Bible can withstand that kind of reading. What do I mean by that kind of reading? I mean not only asking what the Bible is saying, but investigating how it is saying it as equally important. That's what I mean. So we examine the structure, we examine the content, we look for patterns, we look for motif, we look about where dialogue is next to, say, a characterization, and that those things we expect to offer us meaning. So it's a different set of questions with the same aim, say, as, a pastor might be offering his congregation or her congregation on a Sunday.
So there's a richness and a depth to the material that you might miss if you don't pay attention to these sorts of questions.
Oh, you totally miss them. If we don't ask these questions, then we don't know what to do with the Book of Esther that doesn't mention God. If we don't look for patterns, then we don't know what to do with any of it. And we miss really important things. Perhaps we even miss the import of the scriptures as a whole. You know, I think about the people who wrote the scriptures and the time and effort they put into making something beautiful so it could speak to us. And we read it like it's a recipe book.
Yeah.
That to me seems like a crime.
We've talked about the stories of the Bible. Is there a way, Sarah, of summarizing the big story of the Bible?
Okay. No small task.
So have a crack.
I'm going to have a crack at it. I think that the scriptures come to humanity at a time when relationships are broken. However you want to interpret how that is broken, we enter into the Christian story at a time when their relationship with the earth is broken, just like ours is now, like the climate. I mean, we've done some terrible things to this earth we live on. So that's broken. The relationship with each other is broken. I mean, the first story after Adam and Eve is a story of one brother killing another.
Yeah.
You know, and as a consequence and interrelated with that, our relationship with God is broken. So the story starts, there's your orientation, right? Stories always begin with an orientation and then there's a problem and then it builds to a kind of climax and then it resolves. So that's your big fat problem. And then a little bit of a glimmer of life comes in with the Abrahamic covenant, which seeks to actually heal those three things. If you have a look at the, it's really interesting actually to have a look at the promise that God gives Abraham, and it actually speaks to all three parts of those brokenness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I will heal, I'll give you a land, I will heal, I'll give you lots of descendants, you know, there'll be brotherly love, and I will be your God. So it's the healing of this relationship. And of course, the story as it moves up towards the climax, you've got all these moments where instead of keeping that connection with God, human beings somehow manage to kind of resort to brokenness yet again. And that's why that little guy is so important. It's because the little guy actually needs connection. He and she are the ones who cannot do anything without that connection to the earth, to each other, and to God. And so that's why in the biblical story, that's where grace comes. And of course that reaches its climax, doesn't it? In the littlest of the little guys, in a baby who was born to a poor guy in Bethlehem, who achieved, like the shepherd's hut, who achieved offering us an identity we can move into, not by might, but refusing to exercise it. But that's the thing. He refuses to get off the cross. He refuses to assert his might in a politically explosive time, and instead stays small. That's what I think that the story of the scripture is. And that God's grace comes through these moments that we think are worth nothing. We think we have been betrayed. We think we are lost, and we are. We think we have destroyed the earth, and we have. But that God's grace comes through small moments of faithfulness.
This has been Life and Faith with me, Simon Smart.
And me, Justine Toe. And we want to thank Mark Stevens for the interview with Ben Witherington.
Thanks to Daryl Bock and Sarah Goldsby-Smith too. We're going to continue our look at the Bible next week, looking at how to read it, how not to read it, and ask, does this text really have something to say in the face of life's joys and sorrows?
So we had a celebration. We celebrated her life. And of course, it was a deep shock. There were lots of times where we'd just sit down and cry. Of course, that's all true. But we knew in the end that she was in God's hands. And so when people would say to me, well, I'm sorry for your lost loved one, I would say, she's not lost. I know right where to find her.